I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Christine Sturgeon. Christine is the CEO and founder of Define My Style. And Christine, I saw this article about you and your company and the magnificent things you're doing for young girls. It's fabulous, and I just had to talk to you about it. Welcome.
I appreciate you inviting us in to share the message.
So, Christine, right now, your website and your company, Define My Style, you're currently giving about 50,000 teenage and college girls around the United States the opportunity to go online, to design, to create their own handbags, to actually get them manufactured. But really, Define My Style is about much more than just allowing girls to create handbags, isn't it?
Absolutely. So as you said, it's a community or a platform for these girls to create, collaborate, and share, and even bring ideas to life. But as you can imagine, what does that mean as far as an outcome? The girls have a positive experience. They're learning about sales. They're learning about production, promotion. These are lifetime skills, as well as just collaboration. So what is the value of another opinion? How important are the products that we're developing today? What about the products that we carry? And can they be active participants anywhere along that design chain? We're seeing that the girls are more empowered, and they're coming out very, very opinionated if they didn't already start there.
But, you know, as a CPA, to me, the other thing that it seems that this company's doing is you're creating young entrepreneurs. You're creating people who have a passion and can learn about business at such a young age.
Absolutely. And so there are so many outlets for them right now and pools for their attention, if you will. The average girl in this target market is online for over 3 hours a day. They are sending more than 3,000 text messages. So to your point, what can they be learning across this process? Mm-hmm. We've developed this platform so that it reflects the real world environment. Can they design? Do they bring this product to market? Can they see who's viewed their designs? What does that mean from a store perspective? Can I monetize? Which ones are more popular right now? And how do I seek feedback and guidance? We have relationships with fashionistas and stylists who are giving opinions to these young girls that possibly they didn't have access in the past.
So being a CPA, I think I'm creative in a lot of ways, but certainly not in design and fashion and so forth. But do you have to be really creative to participate in this process?
Great question. So it's about having an opinion. You have preferences. Creativity comes in many fashions. If you want to start with a template, you can. If you want to start from scratch, you can. If you want to maybe purchase someone else's bag, we have people who actually want people to design for them. So we have contests every week. We will provide inspiration. If you don't have it yourself, you can always seek guidance from other members, our team itself, as well as that extended network of professionals.
So you've been in business now for a couple of years?
So officially 2 years. This particular part of the site's been up for 1 year, and we've driven 50,000 girls. So it's a platform. There's a need. The girls are seeking opportunities to interact, to really define products and bring something to life in a real environment, not just play and fantasy dressing up, you know,
celebrities. Well, and the nice thing is they're really learning life skills, business skills, and they probably don't even realize that they're learning. It's very much of a fun way to learn.
Exactly. So they count points and how many visitors and how many guests. But to your point, you know, what is it that drove those new people? And oh my goodness, I get better traffic mm-hmm. on Saturdays and Sundays when girls are out of school. If I tell my friends about my design, I see a surge in activity in my portion of Define My Style.
Well, we're out of time, Christine, but if folks want to learn more about Define My Style, what's your website?
www.definemystyle.com. Whether you're a parent looking to inspire your daughter, whether you're an organization that's looking to partner and create some creative challenges, we're doing things with the Cincinnati Art Museum and otherwise, we'd love to introduce you to our programs and extend this platform to motivate this youth.
Well, thank you so much for being my guest. For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your trusted business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner. Today, my guest is Christine Sturgeon. Christine is the CEO and founder of Define My Style. And this is a website that young girls, and you currently have about 50,000 young
Crystal.
Girls, teenagers, and college young women who are on your site designing handbags, collaborating, basically not even realizing they're learning while they're having fun interacting with each other. You started this business in 2008 officially. You've been so successful. How have you gone about doing that in these economic challenging times?
I have a few wonderful things to thank, which would be mentors and guidance over the past. So fantastic investors that were willing to believe in our vision. This is about doing something for our youth. I bootstrapped it for quite some time. So it wasn't until just this past summer that I was able to leave a 40-hour-a-week job. And I built Define My Style in the background every weekend, every evening. Strong friends, collaboration, networks, people who bought into the vision. You know, it is one of these triple bottom line type projects that once people learn more, they're excited to spread the good word and help you out. We're doing good things for individuals and fantastic things for larger communities.
So let's talk about how you got inspired to create Define My Style.
From a conversation with my daughter, it's all about always keeping your eyes open for bright ideas, a new lens, a new way to look at something. She was searching for a back-to-school bag. She knew her preferences. She knew what she wanted, but she couldn't find an actual product that fit that. We built a tool and platform in order to allow her to bring ideas to life.
So is she engaged in Define My Style? Is she excited about watching it grow?
You know, it's been fantastic. The girls have been watching the business develop over a course of time, and I don't think there could be a better life lesson if you ask any of them. So two of them now want to be, one of them a graphic designer, one a fashion stylist, and the other one says, it wouldn't be so bad to develop my own business, Mom.
Well, Christine, thank you so much for being my guest. And,
thank you,
and again,
Crystal.
If folks want to learn more about Define My Style, what's the contact information?
Come visit us at www.definemystyle.com. We're interested in both those creative catalysts, those adults who want to give the gift of creativity, as well as those girls who are creating contributions to our membership and community.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is Business Wise. Our guest today is Michael Debler. Michael is the lead attorney for the Bankruptcy and Creditors Rights Group at Graydon Head, which is a law firm here in Cincinnati. And Michael, I know that you focus primarily on the commercial side of financial restructuring. Are you seeing as much activity on the commercial side today as we have seen over the last few years?
We've seen the real estate crisis, which still has some fallover. We've seen that continue on. A lot of businesses have held on and held on through the recession, hoping that they would their business would turn around. Unfortunately, a lot of them have made it this far, but they can't make it any farther because of the economic conditions they find themselves in today.
There's quite a disparity in terms of whether or not the banks are lending money or not. What are you seeing in your practice?
Every banker will come on your show and tell you that the bank's doors are open for lending. Every business owner will tell you that it's difficult to get loans. And I think actually it's true on both sides. Bankers want to lend, but their requirements are so much tighter than they ever were before. The requirements of business plans, the covenants involved, and a lot of the business owners are very cautious even about using the credit lines that they have today.
Do you think that's true across the board, or do you think there's a distinction between maybe what large banks do and what smaller banks do in terms of credit policies?
I think the issues were that when the financial recession came through, a lot of the big banks froze up their credit departments and concentrated on liquidating out their problem loan assets, which allowed the community banks and the smaller banks to enter into that void and to make loans. These days, it's sort of shifted with Dodd-Frank because there's cost pressures on the smaller banks. They have to now compete with the lower debit charges and all the requirements of Dodd-Frank. The bigger banks have come back in with new lending requirements, just tougher.
For better or worse, the rules that we have in place today are really minimizing the magnitude of loans that business owners can take advantage of. And I think what I see in our practice is even though the banks may be willing to give these folks money, business owners don't want it to come with all of the terms and restrictions. They don't want the personal guarantees. They don't want a lot of the costs and fees that are associated that you just mentioned that have to be there for the banks to make money. Are you seeing that too?
There are no loans out there. There's no non-recourse these days. Everything's going to come with a personal guarantee, perhaps a pledge of personal assets. And the business owners don't have the confidence that tomorrow is going to be a brighter day for them to go into, to do that expansion of their plant, to provide for the hiring of additional workers, because they've seen what's happened. They went through the crisis and they knew when their lenders came out and told them they couldn't use their credit lines anymore.
Well, and that's the real problem with unemployment, don't you think? That businesses are still somewhat reluctant to plunge in and expand their businesses dramatically?
The business owners read the front page and they take their news that there's still a crisis in Europe, that it could spread to this country. There's a lack of confidence that we're on the way back up. They won't hire. They won't, because they know what it's been like to have to lay off their valued employees.
One type of loan program that many businesses just didn't want to go to was the small business SBA loans, but those are gaining popularity and can be a good alternative.
That's correct. And there's a lot of new programs from the SBA. There's a lot of local financial institutions now that specialize in some of the SBA lending. While the process may take a little bit longer, you'll find perhaps the fees are lower and the terms on which you can get that debt are more advantageous to your small business.
People want to contact you or find out more information about how you can help them. What's your contact information?
The best thing for them to do is to go to our website, which is www.graydonhead.com, G-R-A-Y-D-O-N HEAD.com. We've now celebrating our 140th year in this community. So take a look at the website and contact us. We'd be glad to discuss these issues.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
This is BusinessWise. Our guest today is Mike Debler. Mike is the lead partner at Graydon Head here in Cincinnati. It's a law firm, and Mike specializes and focuses on bankruptcy and creditors' rights. Let's talk about bankruptcy, because today it seems like it's very commonplace in many instances.
It's a lot more common than it ever was before. Today, bankruptcy is an option, and it's an option for businesses, large and small, with the fact that GM, Chrysler, American Airlines, Delta, Federated, you name the company, they've all been through a bankruptcy, which has taken some of the stigma away from it.
Many of us have probably either flown on a bankrupt airline or driven a car that was manufactured by a company that was at least on the verge of bankruptcy, you know, in terms of warranties and all that. So you're right. I think people have become a lot more accustomed to it.
Bankruptcy certainly helped GM and Chrysler. There's a debate about whether or not the bailout was a good thing, but at the end of the day, they're now functioning companies, and you will buy a GM or a Chrysler. You will fly on American Airlines, even though it operates in Chapter 11. For a lot of large companies, the bankruptcy aspects are not well seen by the consumers. They buy the product, they use the service, it doesn't have an impact on them.
Why is this less popular for smaller companies?
The problem with smaller companies filing bankruptcy has been really twofold. The first is that it's a complex, complicated procedure that, unfortunately, it costs money. You have to hire your professionals, your accountants, your lawyers, etc. The second problem is the fact that there's no financing. In order to file a bankruptcy, you can get into the process, but you need a lender to help you walk through the process. You can't obtain debtor in possession financing if you're a small business today. There's going to be a ripple effect, because if your small business files bankruptcy and the member of the limited liability company, the officers have guaranteed those loans, while the business reorganizes in bankruptcy, sometimes the lender will chase and pursue the corporate officers to repay their personal guarantees, which may involve a second mortgage on the house or a pledge of certificates of deposits.
Well, what are some other options? If someone really does feel in the heat, they feel the pressure, but they don't want to go through the bankruptcy process, what should they do first?
Consult a good restructuring professional. A lot of times, business owners put their head in the sand and hope that it will become better, and they don't seek a professional until it's too late, where there's no option left but a liquidation. There's local organizations, restructuring consultants. There's a wonderful organization in Cincinnati called the Tri-State Association for Corporate Renewal. Many people will help businesses get back out of the problem. They're the good accountants, the sophisticated accountants that have dealt with these issues. Find yourself a good accountant, a good restructuring lawyer, a turnaround professional. They can help you while there's still a possibility of turning around that business.
And if people would like to find more information about you, Mike Debler, and Graydon Head, how can they do that?
Absolutely. They can go to our website, which is www.graydonhead.com, GraydonHead.com. We've been serving this community for 140 years, and it's been a pleasure to work with the businesses in Cincinnati.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate.
I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is Dr. Richard Colby, the dean of the Hale U.S. Bank College of Business here at Northern Kentucky University. And you're getting ready to launch a brand new, very innovative MBA program this fall, where you're really teaching students to think about business concept and issues in a very integrated way. Why can't we teach students to think in that form earlier in life?
Well, part of the issue really, I think, is that it's hard to measure that. And much of what we do is outcomes based. And I think we need to move away from that model. So the issue of higher education, I think, within the next 10 years is really going to move in the direction we're talking about, where we're teaching people how to think deeply, and how to ask questions. Because the issue is, for me, even as a business school, but I think in a broader context, information is readily available. There's not a lack of information out there. The issue is of people who can digest it and who also can ask the critical questions, what things do I need to know, and how do I go about finding the information to do that? Once I get it, do I evaluate it, understand it? So if we can move all of that down to the lower levels of education, I think that'd be absolutely important.
Well, doesn't it seem like that hasn't happened? I mean, the world has kind of changed a lot since I was in college in terms of what we learn and what's available to us. I mean, nowadays, kids still in school learn how to write cursive. Well, whoever does that anymore, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they really should be learning how to type, I think.
You can get the information and consume information, but how do you take that and then solve problems? And I think businesses today and in the future are going to demand that the workforce be able to hit the road running in terms of problem solving and being innovative.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the new issue. We always talk about the United States being great at innovation. I think other countries are going to catch up with us. If we're talking about hundreds of thousands of Indians and other people learning engineering, that part is going to be taken care of. But the real issue is going to be the people who can then use information to answer questions is going to be the new world of innovation for the United States. I think we need to think about that very broadly.
As a child, right, you have children who are very creative, they play make-believe, right. And then something happens when they go to school, doesn't it? They have to learn to write this particular way, or they have to learn to memorize this 100 concepts. But if you don't teach them how to use that in a way that they can use it and help themselves in businesses or whatever their professional career goals are, what good is learning the 100 concepts or 100 terms?
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly things they absolutely have to know, but there's other things where because we dedicate so much time into testing now,
yes.
I think that one of the issues at the elementary and other school levels is we're preparing them for the test. We're doing lots and lots of testing. Lots of instructional time is being used that way, and we don't get to those higher order functions. And I'm concerned about that.
Do you think we're stifling innovative thinking at the very early age?
I think so. I think we take the fun out of thinking, and I think that's a big deal, and we need to be focused on that going forward.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocates.
I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today, I'm just delighted to have Doug Hall. Doug is the founder of Eureka Ranch. I was going to say founder and CEO of Eureka Ranch.
That's fine.
It's an innovation company that helps businesses make more money.
Fundamentally, what innovation's about is we all go through a life cycle curve. The business starts off, it's great, it's exciting, we cut costs, we make a lot of money, and all of a sudden it starts to go kind of down.
Mm-hmm. Is that because people get comfortable?
It's because they don't reinvent themselves. You have to continually do it. What innovation does is allows you to restart that curve, restart the life cycle again, reboot, restart. And what we find is that for healthy companies, 40% of their sales are in products or services they didn't have 3 years ago. And 40% of their sales are to customers and markets they didn't have 3 years ago. I mean, look at Apple Computer. Mm-hmm. They put themselves out of business every year. They take the number one MP3 player, the iPod, and introduce a new one before the competition can catch up. Tide, Procter & Gamble here in town, 61 innovations in 61 years. It's a process, a continuous process. And so our focus at the ranch is on something we call innovation engineering, which is giving people a disciplined system to help them increase speed and decrease risk with innovation.
Companies here in our region, in the Cincinnati region where we're at, can you help those companies figure out how they can restart themselves as well? Or do you primarily work with young companies?
The ranch's business is in two parts. One part is with the big multinationals, and that's been our historic business for 26 years. About 5 years ago, we connected with the Department of Commerce, a group of them called NIST MEP, the Manufacturing Extension Partnership. We have worked with them and trained their people to help work with small and mid-sized companies and to take those established companies and help them restart. Not on startups, but to help them restart and reboot. Quite frankly, the world's changed, and the U.S. economy, we need those people to restart their companies if we're going to create the jobs that we need in the future.
And I know that you're having, you had, an Innovation Engineering Leadership Institute in Cincinnati on January 17th. What types of things did people walk away with
that? Well, what they learn is they learn at the Leadership Institute, they learn how to create, communicate, and commercialize meaningfully unique ideas. It's a 3-day seminar. We do them twice a month all over the U.S. and around the world. And what these are designed to do is to help the leadership team understand a new way of thinking, a new system of thinking. My dad worked with Dr. Deming, Dr. W. Edwards Deming. He's the guy who came back from Japan, the American statistician, that reinvented American industry in the 80s. And we're trying to do what Deming did for quality, we're doing with innovation.
Do you have any success stories that you can share that people might find interesting?
Well, there's gazillions of them, but let's talk a simple one here in town, Savardi's Bakery. They've turned around and they're realizing great growth. And what'd they do? They invented a new type of stuffed pretzel. They got a patent on it. They're using CNC water jet machines to cut cakes. I mean, they're doing innovation on a regular basis. And that continuous innovation has allowed them to be a growth company. A bakery in the last 3 years, growing.
So that's an example of one of the companies here in our region that's been around for a long time and just restarted themselves. For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Doug Hall. Doug is the founder and the CEO of Eureka Ranch. Eureka Ranch is very well known here in our community. The one thing that fascinates me, and it's something that I think as a business owner, we own our own CPA firm, as you know, and you just rack your brains out thinking about how do we be more innovative? How do we get more ideas? How do you teach people to come up with ideas?
You know, over the years at the Eureka Ranch, we've had all the major companies come, and we measure them. Every 40 minutes, we measure them, the quality, the quantity of ideas, and what was going on. And through this research, out of some 6,000 teams, we found there were three things: stimulus, diversity, and driving out fear. Stimulus is they had to have some spark to create an idea. So what we teach is that when it comes to stimulus, you can do insight mining from your customers. You can do market mining, benchmarking against competitors. Those are good, but they're not great. The great ones are future mining, where you're looking to the future, looking at advanced users, some of the trendsetters, and tech mining, looking at new technologies. I mean, technology drives. In fact, the research says that technology mining is 5 times more effective than insight and market mining. Technology mining means looking at wisdom from professors, published papers. It means looking at patents. It means looking for technologies that you can find maybe in another industry that you can reapply in yours. So, for example, a company turned around and they had a problem with foaming. They found an answer for it in the brewing industry. A pharmaceutical company did by bringing one to the other. It's looking for technologies that can give you that ability to be able to offer your customers something that is truly meaningfully unique. In the case of a CPA firm, it would be a matter of either new technologies. We've got a company, in fact, CPA firm up in Portland, Maine, that went through the program, and they've invented whole new ways to service their customers using internet plus human interfaces together.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole different ways.
What if you are a small company, a business owner just listening today, and you think, you know, I don't have time. I don't have time to stop what I'm doing, to get out of the grill of the day-to-day, to really think about innovation. What's your advice to them?
The first thing is that you got to have to learn. Because if you're caught in, if you're like Lucille Ball in the Chocolate Factory, and you like being miserable, then just stay miserable. But you're going to have to step back and work smarter, not harder. And that's what we're focusing on, is teaching people how to work smarter, not harder. Part of what you have to do is you have to use the full brain power of all the people that work for you or with you, whether they be inside or partners that you work with. You got to leverage them more. See, the old days of command and control where you could tell the workers what to do, those are gone. We've got to use those people that are closer to the work, and we've got to embrace them to be able to create ideas. So that's why with the Department of Commerce, one of the things we do is that we run innovation engineering programs for them to teach them. We even run these green belt programs where we can teach your employees how to think smarter, faster, more creatively, how to create ideas, how to communicate the ideas, and how to commercialize. Because see, what happens is oftentimes we get ideas, but we don't know how to communicate them to others, or we get scared of them. Creativity is stimulus, it's diversity, the collection of the community. That's the potential to the level that we can drive out fear.
Well, I was going to say,
fear shuts us down before we even begin.
Is it fear that holds people back?
It absolutely is fear. Fear is the killer dimension. And in fact, what we're finding is that the fear levels have literally doubled. If I take Procter & Gamble, if I take Frito-Lay, if I take Nike, and I look at them today versus the way they were 10 years ago, and I got to tell you, the levels of fear are at epidemic proportions, even at these incredibly great companies. Fear has risen across the board. And so what we teach people is to go back to the scientific method, or what's called the Deming cycle. Plan, do, study, act, or what we call it is fail fast, fail cheap. You got to get back into that experimentation.
Yes.
When you started with the firm, you just tried stuff. We got to do it fast and cheap.
If folks want to get more information about Eureka Ranch, what's your contact information?
Well, you can go to eurekaranch.com, but really the place that you want to go to is innovationengineering.org, because that's the site that brings together universities, the federal government, and us.
For Business Wise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with Cooney Faulkner and Stevens, your trusted business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is Business Wise. My guest today is Linda Weber. Linda is a partner with the Cincinnati law firm of Montgomery, Rennie, and Johnson, and Linda specializes in employment law. And Linda, I know that you represent employers in the area of employment law, but you also help and advise them on what they can and shouldn't be doing with their employees in terms of overtime and that sort of thing, correct?
I do. That's what I do.
The question that I think is very confusing to many people is what and when is someone entitled to overtime? How does that get determined?
What it comes down to is what classification an employee is in, whether they are exempt from overtime laws, which means they do not need to be paid overtime, and their salary covers all the work they do, whether it's less than 40 hours a week or more than 40 hours a week. The rest of the employees are called non-exempt. That means that they are not exempt from overtime. Those employees are entitled to be paid time and a half for every hour they work over 40 in 1 week.
Well, so what is the definition then? Just looking at someone who's exempt, that means they don't have to be paid overtime.
Correct.
Who is that person?
Employees who fall under what are called the white collar or other exemptions under the wage and hour laws, federal and state wage and hour laws. For example, professionals such as lawyers, doctors, CPAs, those are people who are exempt from overtime. And then there are people who are exempt under either an administrative or an executive exemption. Some of the determinations can be based on very fine lines. Mm-hmm. And we make that analysis on a case-by-case basis based on job descriptions.
So it's not as simple as if somebody's on a salary or not. It really goes to the underlying functions and duties of that person in their job.
That's right. It's not whether they're on salary. It's not what their title is necessarily. It's what their duties are.
If you're an employer or someone listening out there who's an employee and thinking, heck, you know, I've been working all this time and I've never gotten a dime's worth of overtime, what should you do?
Ideally, and I do advise employers about this, you should label employees on their job descriptions as to whether they are exempt or non-exempt, mm-hmm. and that should be based on an analysis by an attorney. And a couple of points of confusion are it's not necessarily over 8 hours in 1 day. It's over 40 hours in 1 week. Those are working
hours.
So not
hours, lunch.
Not lunch, not vacation time, not sick time.
So if I'm an employer and I have employees in my company that tend to work 40 hours a week, if they work 1 hour overtime, if they're not considered exempt, I have to pay them overtime or else I'm potentially exposing myself to all kinds of trouble.
That's true.
So what if someone goes home and I don't know that they're working overtime? Let's just say they're answering email, they maybe didn't get everything they needed to get done through the day, and they work overtime, but they think they're just going to do it on their own time.
And that has created a lot of problems in the age of technology, where people are just looking at their BlackBerries and they think they're just answering a quick email. But if they've already hit that threshold of 40 for the week, and you find out later they're working overtime, you do need to pay them.
Linda, folks want information about how to find more about this issue. How can they contact you?
They can contact me. My firm is Montgomery, Rennie & Johnson, and the website is www.mrjlaw.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm with the CPA firm of Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner, and this is BusinessWise. My guest today is Linda Weber. Linda is a partner with the Cincinnati law firm of Montgomery, Rennie & Johnson, and Linda specializes in employment law. I know you advise many businesses about employment law so that they don't get into trouble in terms of whether or not they're categorizing their employees improperly. And when I say that, I mean whether or not they are considered to be exempt from the overtime rules or non-exempt. Maybe briefly you can just tell us what that distinction is.
Exempt means that employees, based on their duties, what their job description says that they do day in and day out, are exempt from overtime laws. Some examples of people who are exempt are professionals such as doctors, lawyers, CPAs, or people who are in an executive or administrative function. And those who do not fall into one of those exemptions are called non-exempt. And that's really most employees, to mm-hmm. tell you the truth. And those are the people who are entitled to be paid overtime if they work more than 40 in 1 week.
And if someone's on a salary but still should be receiving overtime if they do work more than those 40 hours, does comp time count? For example, can someone, I have a big project, I need them to work, they're going to work 50 hours this week, but I'm going to let them take off 2 days next week or the week after next. Does that get me out of paying overtime?
Not in a private sector business. That is a tool that public sector employers have, such as states and county governments. But so far, private businesses are not able to use comp time, at least outside the work week. You can have someone work 10 hours on Tuesday and 6 hours on Thursday and balance it out, but you can't put it off for a couple weeks.
But let's just say you have a policy, it's written down even as an employer. No overtime. But someone goes home, works overtime. Is that going to count as overtime, even if I, as the employer, have a written policy that says they can't work overtime?
The policies that I usually write or recommend that employers use, they don't say as a black and white matter there will be no overtime, is that you can't work overtime without the approval of the owner or the supervisor, mm-hmm. whoever it is you report to. If you find out later an employee is working more than the hours you think they're working, then you are going to have to pay them. But employers are required to to ensure that the employee's hours are tracked.
How do you track time? I mean, I track my time all the time, but most people don't have to do that.
All non-exempt employees must fill out either a timesheet, or you can use a time clock, you can use a computerized, software system. It doesn't really matter as long as it accurately records the hours. And one good way to do it is have the warning or the message on whatever system you use that you should not work over 40 hours in 1 week without the approval of a supervisor.
And again, that's a per 7 day period.
Per the work week, depending on what your work week is. Monday through Friday, it might be,
So if I'm someone listening today, and let's just say I'm one of those employees who unfortunately have had to really kick in, and I know I haven't been receiving overtime, and now all of a sudden I think, hey, maybe I should have received overtime. What do you do? Because there may be some fear of retaliation in terms of the employer getting upset if you approach them on this issue.
I think there's some concern that employees have. They really should not be concerned, because if employers are getting good advice, they know that questioning or complaining about not receiving overtime is protected under Ohio and federal law.
So in other words, they can't be fired.
They cannot be fired for doing that.
And again, Linda, if folks have questions, how can they find you or your firm to get more information?
They could give me a call. It's Linda Weber at Montgomery, Rennie & Johnson. They can also look at the website, which is www.mrjlaw.com.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner. I'm a CPA with Cooney, Faulkner & Stevens, your trusted business advocate. I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney.
And this is BusinessWise. Today, our guest is Dr. Richard Colby, the dean of the Hale U.S. Bank College of Business here at Northern Kentucky University. And you're getting ready to launch a brand new, very innovative MBA program this fall, where you're really teaching students to think about business concept and issues in a very integrated way. Why can't we teach students to think in that form earlier in life?
Well, part of the issue really, I think, is that it's hard to measure that. And much of what we do is outcomes based. And I think we need to move away from that model. So the issue of higher education, I think, within the next 10 years is really going to move in the direction we're talking about, where we're teaching people how to think deeply, and how to ask questions. Because the issue is, for me, even as a business school, but I think in a broader context, information is readily available. There's not a lack of information out there. The issue is of people who can digest it and who also can ask the critical questions. What things do I need to know, and how do I go about finding the information to do that? Once I get it, do I evaluate it, understand it? So if we can move all of that down to the lower levels of education, I think that'd be absolutely important.
Well, doesn't it seem like that hasn't happened? I mean, the world has kind of changed a lot since I was in college in terms of what we learn and what's available to us. I mean, nowadays, kids still in school learn how to write cursive. Well, whoever does that anymore, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they really should be learning how to type, I think.
You can get the information and consume information, but how do you take that and then solve problems? And I think businesses today and in the future are going to demand that the workforce be able to hit the road running in terms of problem solving and being innovative.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the new issue. We always talk about the United States being great at innovation. I think other countries are going to catch up with us. If we're talking about hundreds of thousands of Indians and other people learning engineering, that part is going to be taken care of. But the real issue is going to be the people who can then use information to answer questions is going to be the new world of innovation for the United States. I think we need to think about that very broadly.
As a child, right, you have children who are very creative, they play make-believe,
right.
And then something happens when they go to school, doesn't it? They have to learn to write this particular way, or they have to learn to memorize this 100 concepts. But if you don't teach them how to use that in a way that they can use it and help themselves in businesses or whatever their professional career goals are, what good is learning the 100 concepts or 100 terms?
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly things they absolutely have to know, but there's other things where because we dedicate so much time into testing now,
yes.
I think that one of the issues at the elementary and other school levels is we're preparing them for the test. We're doing lots and lots of testing. Lots of instructional time is being used that way, and we don't get to those higher order functions. And I'm concerned about that.
Do you think we're stifling innovative thinking at the very early age?
I think so. I think we take the fun out of thinking, and I think that's a big deal, and we need to be focused on that going forward.
For BusinessWise, I'm Crystal Faulkner.
And I'm Tom Cooney. We're with Cooney, Faulkner, and Stevens, your trusted business advocates.